Song of Sixpence, Some Rye. Fandom, BBC's Sherlock, Pushing Daisies, and Posh Nosh, written and read by Fresney, a follow-on story to The Case of the Rolling Wheel and The Long Road. Summary, in which there is some explanation as to why the denizens of the Piehole were in England in the first place, followed by some adventure and a great deal of alliteration.
What care I for my house and my land? What care I for my treasure? What care I for my new-wedded lord? I'm off with a raggle-taggle gypsy's
oar. There may be some question as to why the pie maker, the dead girl, the detective Emerson Codd, and Olive Snook were participating at a comfort food convention in England. The reasons were simple. It was Olive's idea. Olive had mapped an entire campaign composed of persistent conversation, pamphlets, prestige, and convincing Chuck to ask Ned. I think the Piehole should participate in the spectacular, miraculous, vernacular, comfort food, oracular convention in jolly old England. Chuck bobbed on her go-go shod feet and brightly nodded her go-go hatted head. When Chuck said jolly, Ned imagined a jolly old man with a bowl full of jelly and sparklers. The reason for this was simple. When Ned had been at Longborough School for Boys for 3 months, 5 days, 11 hours, and 9 minutes, he'd discovered a black-and-white television in the left attic. Though the television's reception was poor, its reception with Ned was excellent. When he could sneak away to its electronic company, he had watched many an hour of PBS. One endless pledge drive had featured a jolly old jelly-eating Englishman who waved sparklers and explained why Ned should contribute in between morsels of television, sadly, like many things in Ned's life. Just as that pledge drive was at an end and the prospect of the final episode of Blake 7 lay before him, the old television left him by way of dying, and no amount of slapping or tapping by Ned could bring it back. So while his head said he had no desire to go anywhere, his inability to say no to Chuck coupled, and how much did he long for coupling, with his long-held affection for British accents, meant that he said yes. He smiled. He glowed from within in a sense of sheer and utter panic. That Olive came with them to jolly old England was to be expected. It had been her idea. That Emerson Codd came with them was not expected, as the prospect of leaving prospective clients was as dire as a biblical plague to the knit-toting gumshoe. He said only, "There comes a time in every detective's life when he has to make a consultation," clutched a copy of Little Gumshoe under his arm as he said it. Olive had the vague impression that he wanted to pray to a saint. Chuck thought he wanted to ask for a second opinion about his book with an overseas publishing potentate. Ned thought that he wanted to eat meat pie, which, as Ned was a vegetarian for reasons of reanimate meat, Ned avoided making as well as he could, which was very well indeed. There was some validity to each of their impressions and thoughts. The reasons for Emerson's accompaniment had its roots in the year 1976 and in the place New York. Young Emerson, age 15 years, 4 months, 3 days, and 9 minutes, had discovered the color purple and had taken to wearing suits that would have made his hero Shaft proud. Emerson Codd and his mother, Callista Codd, were engaged in a case that young Emerson knew would go down in history as the badass adventure of Codd and Codd in New York. For you see, the son of Irene Adler, the star of many a stage, had been kidnapped by an international villain of mystery, which was an adventure that was very badass indeed. As Adler's stems were long, her pipes pure, and teenage hormones rampant in Emerson's veins, Emerson engaged in a magnificent crush on the Adler, which quite addled his mind. This was to make an impression on young Emerson, as was the hand of his mother on the back of his head, "Snap out of it!" which quite jostled his purple hat with a purple feather. Also to make an impression was the arrival of the consulting detective, which could only be described as extremely badass. As Callista Codd engaged in hot pursuit, the consulting detective jumped down from the top of a dumpster where he'd been examining the byproducts of certain species of rats, and took the heat-bearing suspect down with a wicked right jab of a writing crop, which was the consulting detective's weapon of choice. Wrong! The Codd's weapon of choice was hot lead wrapped in warm wool. But nevertheless, the consulting detective was brilliant, badass, and British. The consulting detective's ability to instantly know the truth of a person impressed even Callista Codd. "That and 2 cents will get you nothing. We're not sharing the fee for rescuing the rich kid." As did the rescue of Adler's son, which involved several extremely dangerous chases down back alleys, a wicked interrogation at a dim sum parlor of repute, and Emerson making a perilous crawl through a heating duct, where it is sad to report he lost a purple patent shoe. Although what really left an impression was the room full of gold underneath the Bank of New York. Sweet, solid gold Jesus! Which, to avoid confusion, was said by both Cods. The theft of which they prevented, and was in some extremely obscure and overly complicated way related to the kidnapping of the Adler's son. Soon their share of the bank reward money in hand, since we were the ones who put you onto the case, we should get a share of the reward, as well as their share of the fee for the rescue of the Adler's son. Sadly, for Emerson at least, the son was more interested in Emerson than the mother, who was very married to her attorney. A fact of the case that everyone had ignored up until that point. To Emerson's astonishment, his own mother had held out her hand to the consulting detective. "It's been a real education watching your work." Since her hand was holding a cheap cigar, the consulting detective took it, identified the tobacco, Blue River Crooks, Virginia tobacco, mass-produced in Crook to Crooks, Pennsylvania, and the year it was grown, 1975. The consulting detective then reached into his black wool coat and pulled out two cigars that he'd been given by a client, giving the layering of cigar smoke in your hair follicles, these will be preferable, and which he handed to Callista and her son. At a nod from his mother, and after a certain amount of adult ritual, that was how Emerson Codd's first cigar was a hecho en Cuba, totalmente a mano gloria cubana cigar. This made an impression. The final impression, as the consulting detective left before the smoke had finished smoking, was from Emerson's partner, best friend, and mother, who pulled out her knitting needles and expressed her opinion of the consulting detective. "Emmy, there goes a man who needs a hobby. Corpses don't keep a body warm at night." Emerson Codd had a hobby, and an array of knitted throws, scarves, and sweaters that kept him very warm. What he did not have was his daughter. However, he had a plan to publish a pop-up book that would serve as a map for a child to find the father who missed her. Before it could be published, he dearly wanted a free consultation, and the consulting detective had answered his last three emails with "boring" and "not a case" and "it is vital that you email me the type of shampoo that she used." This last response Emerson thought might have been sent in error, but he had sent the relevant information. And so it was that while the consulting detective was no saint, Emerson dearly wanted to consult with him, and in the end there was meat pie, but not one Emerson wanted to eat. 2 days, 5 hours, and 22 minutes after their arrival in England, Mr. Pender Pendergast, the organizer of the Spectacular Spectacular Miracular Vernacular Comfort Food Oracular, was found poisoned, bludgeoned, stabbed, and then baked into a pie, with 4 and 20 blackbirds. Dead girl, otherwise known as lonely tourist Charlotte Charles, clapped her hands to her face in a way that was both sad and delighted. Olive was less than delighted. Ned was even less delighted, as Olive did not know his secret, and there could be no questioning of the unfortunate dead man while Olive stood next to him with her hands clutched to her chest. This required fast thinking on the part of Detective Emerson Codd, who, with a wide smile not unlike that of a shark, if a shark wore a purple and pink paisley silk shirt, said, "Itty-bitty?" Olive perked up, because she loved it when she was itty-bitty. "Yes?" Emerson continued, "Since this case clearly implicates you and your boss in homicidal pie-making, we should do some sleuthin'. I'll look over the body for clues. You should get out there in the crowd and find out what the witnesses saw and when they saw it." Olive was torn by the sense that she was once again being shunted aside from the central secret that Ned concealed, and delight that she had been asked to participate in an investigation. Delight and a desire to grill suspects won out. She clapped her hands and said, "I'll wring the witnesses like a dish rag." She scampered off to do just that. She soon met with Miss Minty Marchmont, who was interrogating a chicken into a pan along with some lightly defenestrated carrots, and disturbing chestnuts in oil until queasy and disappointed. Minty smiled at Olive. "I love your accent. It's so exotic." She perished some peas. "Since marrying my husband," she held up her hand and waggled the finger with a wedding ring, "I've met so many exotic people from so many exotic places. Me, the daughter of the landlord of the Marquis of Queensberry, and here I am, talking to someone from Papin County, America." The husband in question, the Honorable Simon Marshmall, clutched a glass of 2002 Rubicon. "Because a day so dire that we are participating in a comfort food convention deserves a wine as dark and deliciously sinful as the silken private parts of an Argentinian tango instructor as he rocks against you on a hot summer night." He threw back his wine and poured himself some more from the bottle clutched in his hand. "At least Pender Pendergast has met his untimely end." Olive said, "So you weren't close to the late Mr. Pendergast?" She grinned up at him like a shark. If a shark wore a lime-green dress and 6-inch green heels. The Honorable Simon Marshmall said, "Close. Ha!" Minty leaned over and said, He would insist on calling the Quill and Tassels at Bray's, that's our award-winning restaurant, signature bread and butter pudding with fennel shadings. Bread and butter pudding. The Honorable Simon Marshmallow snarled. He never even mentioned the fennel. What kind of foodie is that? He should have been drowned in a river years ago. He waved a hand in the air, which astonishingly managed to gesticulate both wildly and forcefully, without spilling a drop of blood. Minty eyed her husband. It did make the mister ever so cross. She loudly whispered, "He's been drinking bottles of Rubicon ever since we got here." The Honorable Simon Marshmallow sneered, "At 125 pounds a bottle, it's cheap and sinful, and that's what a place like this calls for." He glared at the ceiling. "Fluorescent lights! Fluorescent! An industrial carpet!" "Yes, dear," said Minty, who briskly embarrassed some turnips. Olive sighed, because if her first suspect had been here in the open drinking all afternoon, which the stack of empty bottles behind him seemed to confirm, it would have been difficult for him to have baked Mr. Pender Pendergast into a pie, or for that matter walked in a straight line. Meanwhile, of his death, all that Mr. Pender Pendergast had to say on the subject was this, "This is a delicious pie!" On which words he stuffed some of the crust surrounding him into his mouth. "If I'm not mistaken, this is rendered pork lard from pigs raised in Dartmoor!" Mr. Pender Pendergast crunched happily. Said Ned, his eyes firmly on his watch. "Look, fool!" Emerson cut to the chase. "I mostly care about your sorry ass and that your death implicates my associates, and by association, me. And I've got other things to be doing, so cut with the crust and tell us who baked you up!" Sadly, the fact was that Mr. Pender Pendergast had no idea who had done him in and baked him up. Having been done in so many ways, and as far as he knew, he hadn't an enemy in the world. He died chewing, which would have made him happy. "At least he re-died happy," said Chuck, at which point the local police arrived at the scene of the crime. The local police, in the form of the detective inspector, took a dim view of the pie-maker, in that he was a pie-maker, and that Pender Pendergast had been baked in a pie. Emerson had gotten so far as lodging his "Aw, hell no!" protest, when the consulting detective swept in looking precisely as he had in 1976, which wasn't likely in the extreme, but there it was. Since he was still brilliant, presumably still badass, and definitely still British, the consulting detective solved the whodunit in three shakes of a goat's tail, and identified the three murderers. For this was a murderer so thoroughly complete that it required three murderers to complete it, in the form of the King of Diamonds Chestnuts, King Butcher, the Knave of Clubs Cookies, Knave Baker, and the Queen of Strawberry Heart Tarts, Desdemona Filigree Queen Candlestick Maker. As a follow-up, the consulting detective threw a thoroughly baked blackbird at Ned. Given that it was quickly restored to life, which made the consulting detective's companion, the good doctor, exclaim, "Extraordinary!" Ned's nerves were simultaneously shot with unspeakable dread and filled with the emotional glee that fondly remembered PBS engendered in him at the title The Doctor, good or otherwise. Sadly, in the ensuing melee with the to-be-apprehended and apprehensive murderers, nuts were thrown, cookies crumbled, and tarts flung, and the murderers fled out the back door with the detective inspector in pursuit. The consulting detective smiled at the lot of them coolly and nodded to Emerson, "Gumshoe," and swept out like a hurricane of detection. Detective Emerson Codd straightened his knit sweater and chased after the consulting detective, the little gumshoe in a knit bag over his shoulder. Olive galloped close behind, because the hand that she wanted was the truth, and even across the convention center she could see that the consulting detective dealt hands of truth in spades, or possibly aces, maybe a royal flush. Olive wasn't sure of her metaphor. She was sure that this little itty-bitty wasn't going to be left behind. Ned didn't follow, as the pie-maker had no desire to be anywhere near the man who threw a dead blackbird at him. And although this was a case that involved a corpse baked into a pie, Chuck stayed with him, with only a single sigh. Also, as she reflected, someone else was sure to die soon. Instead of hot pursuit, Ned rolled a cool pie-crust, while Chuck got them both plates of Architect's fish and chips, made by their new friend Minty Marshmallow, who loved both their accents and wanted to hear all about Coeur de Coeurs. The Honorable Simon Marshmallow had finally given in to the results of drinking five bottles of 2002 Rubicon, and while not dead, on the morrow would wish he were, for he'd still be in a place with fluorescent lighting and industrial carpet, which he was getting a close and personal relationship with right then. Ned was in the midst of a forward push of his rolling pin when a very pretty girl with dark curling hair brushed by him while texting. Behind her gambolled a gambling goat on a leash. The goat nibbled at Ned and gambled no more. Chuck marveled into her Architect's fish and chips, which were quite good and had a North African sort of influence. Minty got a glint in her eye. My mother-in-law, the late Lady Marshmallow, had a very interesting recipe from the 1700s for disambiguated goat. She put her hands on her hips. I'll get my knives. She trotted out of the booth. The girl didn't look up from her phone. There's no need. Someone will collect the goat. What she did not add was that it was an extremely old goat, and bound to be tough, even if it was thoroughly disambiguated, which it soon would be in a very post-mortem sort of way. After that, it could be said with some accuracy that the pie-maker was very nervous. I'm very nervous. Ned worried at the cuff of his sleeve, even as his gastrointestinal system worried at the lining of his stomach. He worried all through the rest of the day and through the making of 3 separate pies, and was even then worrying his way back to their hotel room. Charlotte bounced along the busy road, down which cars were indeed driving the wrong way. There's nothing to be nervous about, just because the consulting detective threw a blackbird at you, which then came back to life in front of everyone. Emerson and Olive have disappeared in pursuit of murderers, and a goat dropped dead when you touched it. Pish-tosh! We're in jolly old England! Her smile strongly implied that she was using those words because she was in England and feeling rather jolly herself, which was her general reaction to corpses. Being not dead herself, she was a bit morbid. Ned briefly allowed himself to be charmed by Charlotte Charles' use of the word pish and tosh and jolly, but could not overcome the sense that he was being watched. He was being watched. The indispensable auditor pressed down with his fork and tested the firmness of a strawberry in his strawberry pie, which the pie-maker had made just that morning. The taste of it lingered on his tongue like several poetic things metaphorically encompassing all that was good in this world and the next. Given that the pie had been exposed to a rather virulent strain of botrytis fruit rot, the fact that the fruit was as fresh as another metaphor was a delightful clue. He was, all evidence and rumor to the contrary, fond of delight, less so of delirium. That was his younger brother's province, which is why he was well pleased with his pie. He put aside his plate and said, "I would like to offer you a job." Ned, his key card in his hand, his mouth open as he stood in the doorway to his hotel room, said, "What? Who are you? And how did you get in here? And there's no reason to be offering me job, because I am a simple pie maker, and I have nothing to hide except my secret recipes, which I got out of a book. So they aren't secret, and I have no secrets, and—" Charlotte Charles whisked around him without touching him at all. "Hello?" Her eyes widened. "Are you a secret spymaster come to menace us over a mysterious and enigmatic secrets having to do with this being jolly old England?" The indispensable auditor, who might have been a secret spymaster, except that information was classified, flickered his gaze over them, and possibly the rest of the planet besides. "I was thinking a simple monthly annuity, to be paid in recompense for some extremely simple tasks." Chuck clapped her hands. "Recompense! He said recompense!" She turned to Ned. "We could become spies and get licenses to kill, which would be very convenient if you think about it." She turned to the indispensable auditor. "Can you give out licenses to kill?" The indispensable auditor, who did not generally bother with the minutiae of things like licenses, as he had clerks to handle paperwork, said, "Chuck, if I may call you Chuck, if I could and did, I would hardly discuss it so early in our acquaintance." He smiled and tapped the empty plate with an index finger. "Now then, this is excellent pie." Ned clenched his hands, for as a pie maker by trade, and as excellent one at that, he was naturally attuned to comments that didn't refer to pie. "That's what I am, a pie maker. I make pie with fruit, which I don't have to kill with a license, because it's fruit, and that doesn't require a license, unless that requires a license in England." Ned knew that he did not need a license to bake. He had watched multiple seasons of EastEnders. Well, Chuck said, "And by excellent pie, do you mean certain secret spy adventures in which we rappel up and down the walls of certain monasteries that are actually the headquarters of megalomaniacal geniuses that are intent on world domination?" She leaned forward on her shoes and waved her hand in the international sign for megalomaniacal genius. "No, I mean it's excellent pie. Although, a megalomaniacal genius or two may come into matters later. But first I think we should stick to pie." He smiled at them both. He liked pie, although these days he indulged less than he had in his younger years. Still, he swiped a faint swirl of strawberries with his little finger and indulged in a last taste. He wrote several things in a small notebook from his inside pocket. He wrote in a code of his own devising, based on cuneiform, a jazz rhythm by Brubeck, the weight of sixpence, and the pattern in which a handful of rye from his pocket had fallen to the ground on December 31st, 1899. He left without touching either Chuck or Ned, although he did wink one eye as he went. Ned remained nervous. Meanwhile, Olive was in fast pursuit of the truth. They were also being shot at. This was unexpected, given the purported lack of guns in England, and yet it seemed as if everyone but the Americans were packing, for this was not the first, but the fifth exchange of gunfire in their pursuit of the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. In addition, Emerson had been propositioned by 3 separate foreign potentates, 1 lascivious and 2 larcenous, had a blue carbuncle the size of his baby's fist placed in his coat pocket, which he quite liked, and jumped over close-place rooftops, which he did not like. The consulting detective was in ridiculously good shape, and his idea of a case involved a great deal of running around. Emerson considered that he might want to exercise more. Itty Bitty kept pace. Finally, as Olive crouched behind a tree in Dartmoor Park in Chislehurst, with Emerson conveniently trapped behind a different tree, she had the opportunity to ask the burning question that had been ever on her mind. "Consulting detective, I've got a burning need for some consultation. I can tell that you're in the know, and I've got to know. What's the what with the pie maker?" The consulting detective, from behind his own tree, gave her a considering look. The good doctor spoke first. "Is this really how you want to know, and who you want to tell it?" He glanced at the consulting detective and fired another shot. This was not how Olive Snook wanted to know, and who she wanted to tell her. But once the tide of the consulting detective's truth was started, like the sea, it could not be stopped. It could, however, be sung over. Olive opened her mouth and let her song, or technically Billy Joel's song, about honesty, pour out of her. She sang, "If you search for tenderness, it isn't hard to find. You can have the love you need to live, but if you look for truthfulness, you may as well just be blind. It always seemed to be so hard to give." And, quite forgetting that she was in the middle of a heated exchange of bullets, spread her arms wide and stepped away from the tree. Fortunately, Candlestick Maker was an avid music lover and put down her highly unexpected in England gun, which was how she was apprehended. Much to the chagrin of the consulting detective, no one would listen to him until Olive finished her singing. Still, he murmured some comments about the blackbird feathers on the Candlestick Maker's shoes, which were highly irrelevant, but hard to hear over the singing. Desdemona, Filigree Queen, Candlestick Maker clapped. The good doctor opened his mouth to say something, but it was time for more running. Emerson muttered, "This is not how I like to do my detecting," but pushed himself to follow. As they crept through Butcher King's counting house, Olive whispered, "It's been an honor to have been included." The good doctor smiled and moved a little closer behind the stack of counting crates. "After we're done, would you be interested in going out for a pint?" Olive blinked with joy, because she very much would, and then she blinked with "Ow!" because the consulting detective had tackled her, purely to save her from being hit by King Baker's poisoned dart. Olive looked at the consulting detective. "Oh, and ow!" And then, oh, I understand!" She apologized to the good doctor, because given how she felt about the pie maker, she couldn't possibly get involved in another triangle. Triangle is my least favorite instrument. In the end, the villains were safely and firmly ensconced in prison, and Emerson explained about Little Gumshoe. The consulting detective said, "I fail to see the relevance of a book." The good doctor sighed. "He'll look over the book." He straightened his knit sweater. "And he's taking us all out for a pint." The consulting detective grinned. "There's a pub around the corner. The Hanged Man. I kept the owner's sister's boyfriend's best friend's cousin from the noose." They went to the Hangman and had three pints. The consulting detective turned the pages of Little Gumshoe and said, "Juvenile, but not boring." He made five notes on five pages that were clarifying in the extreme. The good doctor looked around his shoulders, much as he had when they were looking at the sad, noseless corpse of Jennifer Wren. This occurred between Potentate Proposition 1 and 2, but has been elided over due to time constraints, which was an image in his head that Emerson could have done without, because he'd been thinking about eating a slice of comfort meat pie. The good doctor made some suggestions for improving things like narrative flow and characterizations. The good doctor had a small smile that turned down on itself. "I've been doing some writing myself lately. Hope it helps." Emerson was sure that it would. Any book that the consulting detective considered not boring could do exactly what Emerson wanted, which was something he'd gladly trade two baby-fisted carbuncles to get. Not that he returned the carbuncle, for which he knitted a very special carbuncle pouch. On the return back across the pond, which was not so much a pond as an ocean, Emerson stored the carbuncle in its knitted pouch in his desk, along with the picture of the girl and an advanced copy of Little Gumshoe, which incorporated the consulting detective and the good doctor's suggested changes. Then it was just a matter of waiting, for every ending is another beginning. Much like this one. This week, at the Pie Hole on Special, fresh fruit lullaberry with French vanilla, and Granny Smith apple with cheddar, lemon tartlet with triple cream, plum and jasmine with creme fraiche. Also, this week from the Posh Nosh Grange, aged disambiguated goat with hound nuts from Baskerville with basil aioli. Further explanations with regards to Rye Sixpence. First, an apology that you've made your way through and perhaps still don't know why Butcher, Baker, and Candlestick Maker killed Mr. Pender Pendergast. Unfortunately, Sherlock explained everything during Olive's song. However, it turned out that Butcher, Baker, and Candlestick Maker went to a midnight showing of Strangers on a Train and tragically misunderstood the central conceit. This, as Sherlock noted in his unheard monologue, is more common than you'd think. Blake 7. I myself had to wait 5 years between watching B7 and seeing the final episode. Perhaps it would be best that Ned never sees it. Emerson's adventure in New York is a reference to the 1976 Sherlock in New York film. Naturally, Emerson would see this as his and his mother's adventure, with some small participation by some British guy. Also, I'm ridiculously fond of young Emerson. The Marshmallows. Ah, Poshnoss. Haven't seen it? That's okay. I'll wait. Since they have a comfort food episode, of course, they really should never be at a comfort food convention. But those carrots won't humiliate themselves. Pretty girl with curling hair. The real question isn't is that not Anthea, but how long has not Anthea been working for the indispensable auditor? There is, of course, no way she could be Heidi, and yet... The indispensable auditor was almost the secret spymaster, but really, only Sherlock gets to wander around telling people that his big brother is the British government. Ah, siblings. Gun battle. Odd how all these people have all these guns. I blame the mysterious trunk in everyone's attic, and possibly global warming. And they need to put pound coins in some bedsits to turn on the electricity. The hangman does a simply lovely cheese plate, so Olive made sure that Chuck went there the night before they left. The blue carbuncle did make a stop in its journey in the gullet of a goose, but you should be assured that it was thoroughly disinfected before it made its way to Emerson's pocket.
Last night you slept on a goose feather bed, with the sheet turned up so bravely up, and tonight you'll sleep in a cold open field, along with a raggle-taggle gypsies all. What care I for a goose feather bed, with the sheet turned up?